You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the Dreaming.
I'm not going to talk too much today, but one thing I do want to touch on today is the whole schmozzle around the recent treaty bill that passed in the Victorian State Parliament. Now, I want to start off by saying, you know, I'm obviously not against reforms that are actually beneficial for our people, you know, government reforms and government legislation that actually addresses the horrific stats that our people live under here in the colony. But I wanted to talk a bit about the way that it's been framed as a treaty. Now, this is something, you know, that has been talked about before on this show, and something that's also talked about a fair bit on similar other shows on 3CR, like Bundrel Fire by Uncle Robbie Thorpe. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not actually a treaty. And it's a bit of a sham that they're calling it a treaty, because it's not. You know, at the end of the day, a treaty is an agreement between two or more sovereign bodies. It's an agreement in international law that carries weight in international law. Now, what has been proposed and what has been pushed through Parliament down here in the colonial state of Victoria is not actually a treaty when we look at the definition of treaty. What it is another piece of state legislation put forward by the colonial state legislation that will be forever at the whim of the government of the day, because, you know, any future government can repeal or amend or suspend this bill. It can abolish this bill. So, you know, when we think about it, it's not actually a treaty and it's not actually a guarantee of anything in the future long term. Now, when we actually look at the wording for this so-called treaty, we actually see the sham that it is. You know, this isn't a piece of legislation that would do stuff like, you know, give land back to mob. You know, it's not something that gives us sovereign control over any of our lands. You know, at best, it's, you know, something that might offer some Torrens titles further down the track. But, you know, even then, like, a Torrens title is not what we want. It's not what we, you know, it's not acknowledging our actual rights over the land. You know, we have unceded sovereign rights over this land. You know, we have rights to do what we want on the land, to manage it and take care of it in the way that we see fit. We also have rights over all of the natural resources, you know, the minerals and the timbers and whatever else. We have rights over the waterways. You know, all of these are sovereign rights that we have not ceded, but the treaty bill doesn't acknowledge any of this. It doesn't grant any of this. You know, I've had a look through it, and as far as I can tell, it doesn't even really go into land rights, let alone land back, two very different things. But, you know, at best, further down the track, it might offer some Torrens titles. And, you know, when we also look at this treaty bill and what it actually proposes, it doesn't give stuff like designated seats in Parliament for mob. It doesn't give mob veto powers over harmful legislation that will impact us. It doesn't give mob a way to table our own legislation. You know, these are all things that you would expect from a actual sovereign treaty, sovereign to sovereign treaty. But these aren't things that are included in the Vic State Treaty. You know, at the end of the day, all it's offered is some more consultation bodies and advisory bodies. You know, bodies that can offer advice and offer consultation, but advice and consultation that doesn't actually have to be listened to, that doesn't have to be implemented, that doesn't have to be acted on by the government. So, you know, it's scraps at the end of the day. You know, it's scraps that is masquerading as a treaty when it's anything but. You know, it's not going to actually actively address our child removal rates or our deaths in custody or our over-incarceration rates. It's just going to create more advisory bodies that, you know, commit to consulting on closing the gap targets. You know, targets that the government has had for many, many years now and has failed, utterly failed to reach. You know, it's not going to ensure that any of these targets are actually met. It's just more advice and consultation. I'm advice and consultation that if you look at the track record of the colonial government, is only going to be ignored anyways. And, you know, it commits to local truth-telling. And don't get me wrong, you know, local truth-telling is great, but this is something that should be a standard. It's not something that you need a, you know, so-called treaty to implement. It's something that should be a standard and the government could implement anyways. So, you know, yeah, it's not worth the paper it's written on, in my opinion. We need an actual, you know, I don't believe in treaties either way. You know, I've looked at the treaty scenario in, you know, so-called New Zealand and the colonies of the United States and of Canada, you know, other Western colonies that were colonized by the British Empire, Western colonies that have similar governance systems to the colonial government here and similar histories in terms of genocide and dispossession and apartheid. And they've all got treaties and we haven't, but when you actually look at their stats, when you look at their conditions and their everyday life, they're not much better off, if at all, than mobile here. You know, treaties over in places like New Zealand and Canada and United States haven't stopped the mass over-incarceration of Indigenous people there or their deaths in custody. Treaties over there haven't stopped the mass child removal that's still happening. Treaties over there haven't guaranteed stuff like housing. You know, you look at those three other countries and their homeless rates for Indigenous people are much the same as they are here. You know, they're the most disenfranchised people, the Indigenous people of those lands. They're the most likely to be homeless. They're the most likely to be incarcerated, the most likely to have their children removed, the most likely to be denied stuff like employment and education opportunities. Exactly the same as here. You know, over there, they've still got their sacred sites that are getting blown up and destroyed, the same as our sacred sites here. They're still being dispossessed of their rights to their minerals and their other natural resources, the same as we are here. They don't have actual proper full control over their lands, you know, same as we've got here. All they've got is GEM and Torrens titles and, you know, other little bits of land that the government can and regularly does come in and retake off them, violates those treaties and retakes it. You know, in fact, there has been hundreds of treaties signed in New Zealand, Canada and United States with the various different Indigenous nations there. And every single one of them has been broken by the colonial occupation of those places. And every single time there's a breach in those treaties, what happens? You know, they go into the colonial courts and the colonial courts rule in favour of the colonial government. Or, at best, you know, in the rare cases where the colonial court does rule in favour of the Indigenous people, it doesn't actually grant them proper compensation or, you know, recompense or, you know, anything like that for what's happened. You know, at best they're given a few measly scraps or, you know, the government's given a little fine or, you know, some other insignificant punishment and insignificant compensation that doesn't actually address the treaty violations that have happened. And, you know, what's happening here in Victoria isn't even at that level. You know, over there they've got treaties that are, you know, they're not an international treaty per se. They probably were when they were first signed. But again, the colonial courts have reinterpreted these treaties and define them as domestic agreements instead of international treaties. But, you know, their treaties carry a lot more weight than what's being proposed here in this state. And even then, it's done nothing to address their circumstances and it's done nothing to lift them out of poverty and lift them out of the circumstances they live in, and they're broken time and time again. So, you know, what faith would we have in the colony of Australia to uphold a bit of state legislation and to actually use that state legislation to benefit First Nations people and to, you know, address our circumstances? They could address our circumstances without a treaty and they've refused to. You know, not failed. I'm not going to say that they've failed to. They've actively refused to, because it's not a failure, it's a refusal. They could do this. They're competent enough to address our circumstances, but they refuse to. So somebody who refuses to address the circumstances that we live under here, third world conditions for many of our people, For a government that refuses to address those third world conditions, what faith and hope would I place in them to introduce another piece of state legislation that's going to somehow be our saving grace? But yeah, as I was saying, if we were to have a treaty here, which, you know, I don't agree with anyways because of the reasons I just mentioned, but if we were to have a treaty, it would need to be an actual sovereign-to-sovereign treaty, not a treaty with the Australian, you know, the Victorian state government or even the Australian federal government. It'll need to be a treaty with the UK. It'll need to be a treaty with the monarchs over there, with people like King Charles, you know, people who hold legislative power and authority over the Australian government, people who have the ability to, you know, come in and compel the Australian government to act on a treaty and to respect it and adhere to it. Even now, I don't place much faith in that. But, you know, if you had an actual sovereign-to-sovereign international treaty, it'll at least mean that when there is treaty breaches, we could go to higher authorities than the Australian colonial courts to try and address those breaches. You know, we could go into international courts and try and address it that way. You know, again, I don't place much faith or stock in the UN and in the ICJ and whatever else. But, you know, it's a lot better than trying to appeal to the Victoria Supreme Court or, you know, the Australian High Court, which will be the avenues that happen if there is a breach of a domestic agreement here. But yeah, it's just something to think about, you know. It's, you know, don't get me wrong, as I said at the start, if there's actual beneficial legislation for our mob, I'm not going to, you know, shoot that down. I welcome that. But I don't see how this is going to be actually something that addresses the horrific conditions that so many of our mob continue to live under here in this colony. I'll be back again next week. Next week I'm going to go back to some of the programming I've been doing over the last few weeks, talking a lot about liberalism. I've been up to a few different projects as well in the background. Some that I can't announce yet, but stay tuned. There's going to be some interesting works coming out soon, early next year probably. But, you know, I'll announce that as we get a bit closer. But yeah, I've been working on a few things in the background, and one of the things I have been working on though is a book. I'm writing a book on liberalism in particular, like a critique of liberalism, exploring its history, how it first came about, you know, how it influenced stuff like the European colonial era and imperialism today, as well as the politics that we live under today, and the way that, you know, various institutions operate, the way that we even interact with each other and with nature on those personal sort of levels. But yeah, it's going to be quite a good book. Not to gas myself up, but, you know, I reckon it's going to be quite a good book. Something, there's not too many similar books out there. There's, you know, a lot of different authors have, and fear, you know, people who are into theory and whatever else, have really spoken at length about liberalism, but usually in very sort of specific or, you know, very niche kind of context. You know, we've got, like, for example, a small pamphlet by Mao, Combat Liberalism, talking about the way that liberalism manifests on a personal level and those acts of liberalism that we often tend to play out in our lives and in our interactions with others. We've also had people like Lwazi Leshaba, who is a African man from South Africa who really looked at the way that liberalism and modernity and development are all tied in together, and that whole Eurocentric outlook when we think about modernity and development, and how that is tied to liberalism. There's a few other, you know, really great authors who have spoken at length about that. I'm actually going to be looking at some of their works in my book and kind of doing a bit of a case study on some of these different texts in the book that I'm writing. But yeah, next week I might have a bit more of a yarn about it. Might talk a bit more at length about what the book's about and the particular topics that are within it, and give a bit of a sneak peek at what I've written so far.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.